This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's hard to believe that South Shore Clean Cities is 20 years old. But that's right. It's the 20th anniversary is being celebrated here. And we have with us the Executive Director, Carl Lissick, to talk about it. Carl, thanks for joining us in the studio.
Chris, as always, thank you for having me.
It's hard to believe, as I said, that that South Shore Cities has been in existence for 20 years now. Take us all the way back to the beginning, if you can, and tell us a little bit how South Shore Clean Cities got started.
Sure. First of all, I want to wish you a happy Father's Day, Chris.
Oh, thanks.
So, again, South Shore Clean Cities actually started on June 15th of 1999. It was founded as the 71st U.S. Department of Energy Clean Cities Coalition. And this was actually started, Chris, by members of the NIPSCO organization and variety of organizations throughout Northwest Indiana. It originated as Lake, Porter, and LaPorte counties back when this was started. And the goal really was to reduce our dependence on imported oil. This started with like the US EPA when they were trying to look at ways of air pollution and looking at things, at gas prices. And this really was a kickoff here in Northwest Indiana when they formed the 501c3 not-for-profit. Mm-hmm. And it actually started with another lady running the organization as a Clean Cities group, and Liz Williams, and then it was future forward, Miss Deb Parker from Hammond actually was the next director of operations here for Clean Cities. And so I had gotten started with Clean Cities back in 2005 when my wife and I had started our company. We were actually a board member of Clean Cities and looking at ways of helping our clients look at ways of going green. And I always like to say we were green, going green before green was cool.
That's right.
And,
That's right.
Very excited about that. So we've, with the Clean Cities Coalition, this is a national organization across the United States. We've been very blessed to have worked with numerous people. And there's so many people, so many organizations, so many nonprofits, including Lakeshore, that have really made us today one of the leading Department of Energy coalitions in the United States.
We know the South Shore Clean Cities now focuses a lot on sustainable transportation modes and equipment and infrastructure and the like here. Has it always been that way, or did the South Shore Clean Cities idea get a boost because it was organized elsewhere and it was set up here in Northwest Indiana?
I think like everything is, Indiana in general, Northwest Indiana never really gets credit for all the great things, all the great leadership that we actually do have. One of the things that we did see was people were always looking at ways of doing things better. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that we've always admired about the leadership here of Northwest Indiana. So with this, this was foreign in regards to a lot of things that we were working with, speaking about alternative fuels. And now, as you representatives of the media, you see every day there's someone that's talking about some type of alternative fuel, alternative energy. So this has become, a daily occurrence for all of us as consumers and, advocacy for cleaner air here in Northern Indiana. So just to say that we've embraced it, I think we've just been very lucky with a lot of the leadership here in Northwest Indiana. And it's expanded our capabilities, not just here in Northwest Indiana, but throughout the state of Indiana.
How did the idea of coming up with a way to create a transportation with cleaner fuels get started? What was the progression? What did the vehicles start in with, and they've kind of moved up through the years to become what they are now?
Well, I think a lot of it has been with the major auto manufacturers, the truck manufacturers, looking at ways of improving economy, improving performance. When we started 20 years ago, if you looked at the electric vehicles of yesteryear, if you will, to now, we've seen numerous changes from gasoline vehicles with the mileage improvements that we've seen. So I think, with the transformation of transportation, if you will, we're just going to see, we've seen a lot of changes. And again, over these 20 years, as we celebrate our 20-year anniversary, we've just seen this progression of all these different types of vehicles and different types of technologies. And, electric really was not one of those groups that we really talked about 20 years ago. What mm-hmm. we talked about was, improvements in performance and gas mileage with gasoline vehicles working on biodiesel, natural gas, propane advocates. And again, today that serves the portfolio of things that we're working on. And new to that twist is hydrogen. And again, I think you're going to be hearing a lot more about hydrogen fuels here in Northwest Indiana very soon.
I know the status, the statistics have come out here, and you can quote all kinds of numbers, and it gets kind of confusing sometimes. And I know that the latest report that you managed to, at least the members of South Shore Clean Cities, have reduced greenhouse gas emissions by, 607,000 tons. And then you reduce the amount of gasoline equivalents down to by some 93 million tons. It's still, when you talk about it, you're talking about at least noticeably cleaner air and certainly less expensive operations for these companies that have to have vehicles on the road.
Absolutely. And again, I think, you know, looking into autonomous vehicles, looking at everything that is coming to the future, I think one of the things that we really are taking a leadership role here in Northwest Indiana is to be the go-to organization for people to learn about all these different types of technologies and fuels and to be a resource. And I think, again, what you're going to see is our air continues to get cleaner. Our technology continues to grow. I think there's just a tremendous amount of things that we're going to see working a lot with our universities, working with our schools, our local schools. There's not everybody wants to go to college, and we see a huge shortage of truck drivers. We see a huge shortage of mechanics, and that this is creating a situation not only for Northwest Indiana but for our state. And that is something that we're pledging to move forward as we move on to our next 20 years.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Carl Lissick, who's the executive director of South Shore Clean Cities. South Shore Clean Cities, the nonprofit organization, is into now its 20th year of operation. And some of the information that they mentioned, some of the projects that are out there, kind of go. There are three major ones, and let's talk a little bit more about them. The first one is it talks about NIPSCO, because NIPSCO was one of the founding partners in this, about their In Charge project. Tell us about that.
Sure. If you remember, a few years ago, NIPSCO had initiated a project actually to provide charging stations for homeowners and for public charging. And so we actually were the project manager on behalf of NIPSCO, where we worked with all of our communities, worked with the consumers on educating them and giving them opportunities actually to, as they bought electric vehicles, that they would get electric charging stations installed in their garages. And then we also work with our variety of communities throughout the NIPSCO Electric territory to install public charging stations. So very successful program, very highly touted across the state and throughout the United States. And it was really a model program that I think other states and other utilities looked at. So we're very excited about how that actually turned out. And we're looking forward to future endeavors with NIPSCO and other utilities here in the state.
And I go from NIPSCO to BP. BP, of course, the fuel maker, is always looking for different avenues, I suppose, for business. But they're also looking for ways to help become better stewards of the environment. The environment, cleaner air through diesel emissions reductions. They've got their little. Is it BP Cater? I think
we call it the BP Cater project.
It's a grant program,
and it was basically BP cleaner air through diesel emission reductions. And again, I think one of the things that we did work with BP was, you know, people will always say to us, since you're trying to reduce our dependence on imported oil, that we don't work with BP. And BP is actually one of our biggest supporters. And so working with BP, we had some grant funding to work with communities and businesses to help them reduce diesel emissions here in Northwest Indiana. And so it was a $500,000 project that we leveraged other federal grants. And so we turned it into almost a $1 million project to implement different things like cleaner school buses, cleaner transportation activities with a variety of municipalities here in Northwest Indiana.
And I know that Clean Cities here in Northwest Indiana and the region, we're talking not only Indiana but Michigan too, has been very much involved in the Green Fleet program. We were talking a little bit earlier about that, or talking about some of the things that have changed over the years and how it's progressed along. Tell us more about that.
Absolutely. So we are engaged with Northwest Indiana Regional Planning Commission, NERPC, who's a frequent visitor to this program. And part of what we had done is we worked with NERPC to implement a green fleet program, not only with them and with Michigan Area Council of Governments and the state of Indiana. So the goal really is that we want every business, every community here in Northwest Indiana and the state actually to be part of this consortium, if you will, to learn about alternative fuels, to learn about different things that they can do as a fleet to reduce dependence on imported oil, but also to reduce emissions. And so with our NERPC program, we have over 57 different communities and businesses here in Northwest Indiana that have been a part of this. And so, again, as you start seeing some of the air emission improvements here, I credit that to the NERPC Green Fleet Program.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've talked about the programs that have been set up in the past or are running now in many places. What looks ahead for the future for South Shore Clean Cities?
Well, again, I think we are going to announce on June 18th, which is our 20-year anniversary party, we're going to be making a major announcement about a program that we've been working on for the last several years. It's called the Michigan to Montana program. And basically what we were doing is we're taking alternative fuels along I-94 to Montana. So you can travel along I-94. The mission of this program was to take, you could have alternative fuels, whether it would be electric, propane, natural gas, gasoline, or biofuels. And you could drive from Canada all the way to Montana. And so we're very excited about this announcement that we have upcoming and to talk about Indiana's progression on this. And you'll hear more about that on June 18th.
Well, it's going to be quite a celebration, to be sure, because you hit this 20th anniversary and you have a chance to look back, as we've tried to do in our conversation, and look ahead to the future. And you mentioned about some of the things that you have in the works there as well. What kind of partnerships are you looking at in the future besides the well-established and historic ones that you've had?
I think, again, what people tend to forget is we are a learning resource. I think we're like one of the first stop shops for anybody that's interested, consumers. The Clean Cities program was really working more with major fleets, major users of diesel equipment and fuels, and now we've gone more to working with consumers. So working with car dealerships, working with the various organizations throughout the state of Indiana here on making them aware of some of the different laws, some of the different significant things that are happening. But I think here in 2019, we've been working on the Volkswagen settlement that we've talked about. The Volkswagen settlement is a $41 million settlement the state of Indiana has to reduce diesel emissions throughout the state. And so we've been working very diligently to help our communities, help our schools, help businesses to take advantage of some of this funding. And then what we hope to show is these endeavors bringing some of this federal or this non-federal dollars back to Northwest Indiana. So we're very excited about those partnerships, Chris.
Now, I know that you've been involved directly with South Shore Clean Cities for about 14, almost 15 years.
Correct.
Now.
Yes, sir.
Back in the early 2000s. You mentioned some of these projects. Now, if you had to be pressed to find one or two of the ones that you're the most proud of, what would they be?
I think the biggest thing that we're very proud of is just all the different partnerships, the opportunity to have worked with all these different organizations. And I think it's the people. You know, again, as we spoke before, Chris, I don't think Northwest Indiana or even the state of Indiana gets enough credit about all the great things that are happening. And, you know, part of what we like to do is find people doing the right things. And I really, truly believe that people want to do the right thing. So I think, you know, moving forward and looking at some of these accomplishments, it's not about South Shore Clean Cities. It's the representatives. It's about all these different organizations and folks that have really made the difference. And there's so many people, Chris, that it's very hard just to say there's one that really sticks out. But I think, you know, working with a lot of the leadership here of Northwest Indiana, we've just seen the kindness, the thoughtfulness that, you know, a lot of our leaders really want to make a difference. And sometimes they don't know the right ways of improving that. So I think that's where we have come in to be a resource for our communities, our schools, and our businesses, to let them know some of the tax advantages, to look at some of the clean air initiatives. And, you know, I think it all adds up to one thing. It all adds up to cleaner air here in Northwest Indiana and the future of Northwest Indiana. So, you know, we're just so excited about, you know, the last 20 years, but moving forward, we have just begun. I can just tell you that with all the initiatives and all the different things that we've got planned in the works with our different organizations, working with NERPC and the state of Indiana and so many other folks, we're excited about what the future brings in transportation.
It sounds like in the last 20 years that South Shore Clean Cities has created a very, very colorful, although mostly green, mosaic because of all the partners that have gotten together to help make things happen. And the future is just going to bring even more, certainly, greenness and other colors to the picture, too, I bet.
We call it transformational. Yeah. And again, yeah. I think what we see, the future of transportation here in Northwest Indiana is going to be transformational for the state of Indiana.
Well, Carl, thank you for spending time with us to talk about this today. Once again, the special event coming up on June 18th is actually the 20th anniversary celebration is going to happen, and folks are going to get together and note that, and that's the starting point for the next 20 years, no doubt.
Absolutely.
Well, Carl, thank you for coming by and bringing us up to date, talking about the past, about how South Shore Clean Cities got started, how it's progressed over the last 20 years, and a little peek ahead into the future, too, and we'll be looking forward to hearing more from you in the future, too.
Thank you, Chris.
And Carl Lissick is Executive Director of South Shore Clean Cities. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. The proposed digital crossroads at Lake Michigan Data Center is getting more press these days, including being highlighted in an article in one of the recent issues of the Northwest Indiana Business Magazine. The managing director of operations for the new facility is a seasoned veteran of the data industry. We talked with David Hood about the experience that he's bringing to the position he's in now, and the latest about the massive project that is going up along the Hammond Lakefront. For folks that are not familiar, Mr. Hood, with your work, know that you've spent a lot of time working in telecommunications and in data center management, but in your most recent jobs have been in Chicago. What does a data center manager really do?
Well, at the most basic level, we keep all the blinking lights green. Mitigate any errors, any potential threats to data transmissions and compute power. And, a home user, say, we make sure that their connection to either Netflix, YouTube, whatever they're connecting to is maintained so that it doesn't go down and they have any outages.
Now, a lot of your work, I know, has been working with the telecommunications infrastructure, which certainly fits this very well. Interested you, number one, in what this job potential might be compared to what you were doing over in Chicago?
Well, considering this whole project, the ability to maintain people's connectivity, but do it in a more environmentally friendly manner, is certainly a big draw. The facility we have here has the potential to utilize a lot more green power than a lot of data centers in the area, frankly. Mm-hmm. There's just an easier, more flexible environment in which we can create and additionally maintain green power and do it economically as well. Just the ability to work with the state of Indiana has been great as well. But the real key, besides all the help the legislation's given us, is the green power piece and being able to do that in the right way this time.
When you talk about being able to take a project like what you've worked on in the past in Chicago and other places and basically follow along, I guess, to a point in the same sort of operation that's being proposed here along Lake Michigan, but with this new component, the green energy part of it, is that probably the newest and the most exciting part of what you're going to be doing?
That is correct. I would say everybody wants to have the data centers up and running, but it takes a lot of energy to do that. And it can take energy, from coal plants just to get it done. We're trying to avoid that as much as possible. And like I said, just the ability to utilize wind, the solar aspect of being able to provide power for this, and our managing members' design theory behind consolidating all these power sources, renewable and traditional power, is just very exciting and kind of a neater project to work on than just a normal data center. Mm-hmm. It's almost as exciting as building a data center, say, in Iceland, where every power is really cheap and the cooling is free.
And, of course, in a way here, too, you've got the advantage of being right next to this big lake, which will cool things very nicely, too, right?
Very nicely, yes.
When you had a chance to sit down and talk with Peter Feldman and with Tom Dockich of Digital Crossroads, and I guess in some of your discussions you had, what did they say that seemed to interest you the most about this project?
The availability of the water and then just space to do the green power. And that's a good question. known Pete for a great many years, and they've always had various projects that involve the green power aspect. So it's been an ongoing discussion, and gratefully they've involved me in some of those discussions over the years. So, you know, the minute this was brought up, it was just a renewal of an ongoing discussion that was just as exciting as it was, you know, maybe 10 years ago when we first started working together.
Mm-hmm. So he's followed through in a lot of his projects and other cases, perhaps, that with the green concept, and this is just the latest generation of that?
That is correct, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's always been one of the top pieces on his agenda to get a data center as green as possible.
Any contact with what this tech incubator is going to be doing?
We haven't had much time to discuss that quite yet due to, you know, the nature of getting a building and a project started, but we're looking forward to those discussions.
What can you tell us on the latest on the construction that is underway for the building along the lake right now?
We just foundation going now. The rest of the actual construction of the building is about to become officially, I guess it's officially underway, but, you know, things just ramp up, and we're really gathering some steam now, and once that is fully rolling, and then, you know, we have walls up, we'll be able to start paying a little more attention to some of these other things like the tech incubator.
You're obviously going to have most of your space dedicated to the data center itself and all of the
right.
specialized equipment that it has to go in there. And then, of course, you've got, I guess, a very, very special, very, very green HVAC system, I guess, to put in there too, don't you?
It just takes a lot of airflow, and we're gonna have a lot of airflow to accommodate that between that and the lake water, yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, what is also planned on the outside on the property there? You'll have a lot of extra room to work with, and you have a lot of space, luckily, that you'll have to be able to plan for the future and any future expansion. But what else, at least in this first phase of the data center project, are you hoping to take advantage of along Lake Michigan?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question.
Had to spend a lot of time on the building itself, I guess, and this is some nice things you can kind of sketch out in your mind and on paper and look to the future for.
And there's just so much possibility here that even like the tech incubator, we are looking forward to the next 6 months when we can start looking towards the future and get past the initial first phase, building and getting that off the off the drawing board and out onto the field. There's quite a few things that, you know, just you potentially wind power, what we talked about, the solar aspect, the amount of lake cooling, all those things, and just for phase two, how to more efficiently utilize these aspects and not just the phase one stuff, but really fine-tuning it to make it work right and make it work better than, you know, say any other data center around. So there's a great deal of opportunity here. It's just going to take us a little bit of time to get through all the possibilities and, you know, kind of, like I say, fine-tune what we really want to do with the potential here.
We're talking with David Hood. He is the new Managing Director of Operations for the brand-new Digital Crossroads at Lake Michigan, the data center that is currently under construction along Lake Michigan in what used to be the footprint of the old state line generating plant that used to produce electricity, and now will take advantage of the best in the green energy to create electricity and keep the lights on and the equipment running. I know that you're probably working more closely with Peter Feldman and maybe with Tom Dockich about initial employment plans or how many folks you want to have once the facility is built and up and running.
Yeah, ultimately we're going to have around 40 to potentially 50 people employed in the building directly in various aspects of managing the site. But just having a data center is going to expand. You know, our tenants are going to have employees as well.
Right.
So it's a little bit than just looking at our direct employment, our W-2 guys. Depending on the people we have moving in, and we're looking at hyperscale clients in the data center industry, which are the bigger guys, they're going to have probably a dozen per client, technicians and other support staff in the facility working through them as well, and they're all looking to hire local talent, and we'll be helpful and we do what we can to help develop that local talent as well.
You've worked in the past primarily on such topics as rural broadband around Indiana and the like. Do you think that with this data center up and running, obviously it's going to take care of Northwest Indiana business and industry for the needs that they may have, do you think that this may be a good link to be able to expand broadband in Indiana?
Absolutely. We're looking to create a hub for a lot of the broadband, expand everything to accommodate the 5G capabilities, the Internet of Things of the future. So, yes, we're looking at ways to consolidate all the area fiber optic assets into the facility to make sure that we're prepared for the future and what comes beyond the next wave of cellular technology.
Well, it certainly sounds like that with this computing data center that that you're helping supervise the construction of there in Hammond, the prospect of more business in Northwest Indiana, it'll be part of all that too within the tech incubator and a lot of other things that are going to be related there on the site. It's just nothing but looking up, I suppose, right now.
Absolutely. It's a very exciting project. I'm happy to be here. We've got a great team of people. The support from the local government all the way up to Indianapolis has been fantastic. So many positives here that it's almost hard to count.
Well, Mr. Hood, thank you very much for spending time to talk with us about a little about yourself and about the business, and in particular what you're going to be managing and the operations there at the Digital Crossroads at Lake Michigan as the facility gets up and running here in the months and the years ahead. Thanks for spending some time with us today.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your time as well.
A new report from the Center for Business and Economic Research at Ball State University in Muncie is updating the quality of life rankings for every single county in Indiana. And we have with us one of the people who's especially behind this project, Professor Michael Hicks. He's a Ball State University economics professor, and he is the executive director of the CBER. And Professor Hicks, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Good to be with you, Chris.
Now, I mentioned here that this has been around for a while. This is a project, I guess, that started in 2012. What was the initial thought in creating the, what is called the Community Asset Inventory and Rankings?
Well, actually, in late 2010, some Lieutenant Governor's office asked us to give every county in Indiana sort of a objective evaluation of what we thought would be the key factors in the long-term economic vitality of those counties. And from that sprang forth this community asset inventory and ranking, which looked at six broad areas: arts and entertainment, government, impact, and economy, two different measures of human capital, one education, one health, and then people, really demographic information, and then two areas that were public amenities. One were changeable things, the commercial amenities that people care about, restaurants and those sorts of things, and then static amenities like lake shores and riverfronts and terrain availability, state and national parks and wildlife areas. So we compiled these into a scorecard, and then we've just updated that for this year.
Were these all topics that had maybe had come up and maybe not quite as expansively addressed, but had been addressed maybe in some previous studies or reports?
Yeah, good question. So every one of these areas has appeared in the economic literature as things that matter to economic vitality. So, large list of static amenities, amenities are obviously very important. Health, education, demographic conditions, the quality of government, tax rates, whether or not you're participating in, things to promote civic life like Main Street, and then arts, entertainment, all the things that households look for when they relocate, and then businesses look for households when they relocate. And so these are important to businesses indirectly, whether they know it or not.
I know that you mentioned in some of the remarks that came out here when the report was released earlier was the fact that maybe a county's economy is looking at something on maybe a shorter basis rather than looking at the long-run picture. And I guess the data doesn't always show a lot of these things that you try to bring up here. You may be looking more or only seeing more of the unemployment rate or maybe property tax rates or things like that. But you need other factors and some really big factors, it seems, to be able to show to people. And as you say, it's part of what businesses and households look at when they're looking at maybe someplace next to live or work.
Right, and so it's that's a ubiquitous part of the economy. We report unemployment rates every month, and we have all kinds of cascading economic information like the stock market, and when in fact the things that really, really matter, that dictate household location choice, that dictate how prosperous you're going to be in the place that you are, and then are likely to cause businesses to relocate there are fundamental things. How good are your schools? How good is your public infrastructure, which is a function of how effective your local government is? How healthy is your workforce? What type of amenities are going to be available for people who would like to move here? Those things matter a lot. What the unemployment rate was last week doesn't matter a whit in any of those decisions. None of us choose a place to live or what occupation to choose or you know what career to go into based upon the short-run variables. It's all about the longer-term things that we tend to ignore or we tend to gloss over as we look at our communities.
I know in past conversations that we have had have dealt with things like the housing markets, for example, and how things improved or have not improved in counties around the state, here in Northwest Indiana in particular. And I know that your research team built a lot of this in when they did this update here on the report that's out there now, didn't they?
Yeah, we did. We added a housing value barometer. And the reason we did that, and I can't ever stress this enough, so many people worry about housing markets. Housing a home, the price of that home is the single best measure of what's good and bad in a community. You take two different homes, you put them in two different places. The one with the higher tax rates, the value of the home is going to be lower. The place with better schools, the value is going to be higher. The place with the better amenities and walking trails, the value of that home will be higher. The place with the higher crime will be lower. And so home prices tend to capture everything that's good and bad about a community. Economists have been studying this with some very good micro data for almost a half century now. And so your home prices, if they're rising or declining, if they're higher or lower than your neighboring counties, gives you the best picture of what's happening. And so that barometer is a way of reinforcing all the other things in this metric and how that's your, I use your housing value as your GPA for this report card.
Now, we've talked here a bit about the mission of the CBER in putting up the original community asset inventory and rankings and how it's gotten updated over the years, including the one report that's just out now. Let's talk specifics here in Northwest Indiana. How do I guess you hesitate to call it a report card, but I'm sure for some it probably would be that way. How did Lake and Porter and LaPorte counties in particular and some of our collar counties, if you want to call them that, here in Northwest Indiana do as far as meeting up with some of the standards that you all folks had set in this?
Well, there was a lot of changes year to year. So, you know, the three counties that you talk about in 2012 had Lake and LaPorte County had C's in what I think is the most important thing, which is the, you know, education of human cap and human capital. And then Porter County had an A. And so if you look at the educational attainment of the workforce, the share with a high school diploma or a college degree, if you look at the graduation rates from the local schools, and if you look at the I-STEP pass rates of the public schools in each of those counties, this was an average to above average area. If you shift, and again, this is all compared to other Indiana counties. If you shift forward into 2018, you can see that in terms of education, Lake County has slipped into the D range, really driven primarily by the deep problems in Gary schools. They're such a big school corporation and have such a big influence overall, while both LaPorte and Porter County stayed the same. The health for both, another measure of human capital is how healthy people are. So we looked at fertility rates, death rates, premature death rates, poor and fair health rates. These are all gathered by the Centers for Disease Control, crash, death, cancer incidents against three different types, asthma, and then the presence or absence of food deserts. And both LaPorte County and Lake County slipped into D range. So we're seeing, you know, as the country as a whole, and certainly Indiana is working on some of these, you know, long-term indicators of health. We see Porter County continuing to do fairly well, but Lake and well, across the region, the health slipped, moves and sort of all slipped a grade. It was C for LaPorte and Lake and a B for Porter, and then each slipped a grade this year. But human capital stayed the same in terms of education for both Porter and LaPorte, which, you know, is, I think, really the most important part of any economic development discussion is how good are schools and how well educated is the workforce.
Now, taking a look at the numbers here in Lake Porter and LaPorte counties in particular, as it turned out in the report, and we should mention, too, that you can see the whole thing if you really want to find out more about the individual counties that we've referred to and all the others around here. The website address is cair.cberdata, that's all one word, .org. It's a long address that you type in on your URL bar of your computer, but that will open up to the page that the Center for Business and Economic Research has set up specifically, and then you can go down the list there, find the county, and take a look at the data there too. Have you gotten any response from any officials that have taken an early look at the data since it's come out, whether they're happy or whether they're shocked and appalled or something of
that
nature?
Well, it's like any report card. If you get an A or maybe a B, you're happy. If you get a D or an F, you're not. So we hear, as we did in 2012, this was very eye-opening. I mean, and it shouldn't surprise anybody that every chamber of commerce and every city says the same things about themselves. It's a great community, great place to raise a family. The weather is fine. The schools are great. The workforce is, you know, well-skilled and ready to work. Everybody says that self-assessment is ubiquitous. You know, it's like looking in the mirror and, you know, we all look like, your favorite TV star. The fact of the matter is that, there's wide variation in how good Indiana communities are doing across these. And there's inter-county variation. So don't get me wrong, within each county there's a great deal of variation as well. But you know, people are looking at communities, they're thinking about counties, they're drawing workforce from a multi-county region. So even if you're a good community stuck in a bad county, you sort of face the environment of this, you know, poor economic conditions, particularly in human capital, dragging you down. So we've had officials, you know, say to us, the most common complaint is, this is going to make businesses not look at us. And I always chuckle, these data are well known to everybody who thinks about relocating or thinks about moving a business. And so households and businesses that are thinking about coming to your community know all of this information. The only people who seem to be unaware of it are those of us who live in the communities that have been sort of fed a steady diet of everything is fine, and we're just one more factory away from prosperity, when in fact for much of Indiana it's going to be a long haul of improving education and the quality of the workforce to see that prosperity that I think most Hoosiers want to see in their communities.
As you mentioned earlier here at the beginning of our conversation, it's more of a long-term, data gathering tool to be able to give a county and the people within that particular county an idea. Well, this is how we're doing right now, and we can just kind of plan accordingly. You mentioned, for example, about the issues dealing with health and safety and the food deserts problem that we note here, in Lake County in particular. And we have organizations that are doing their best to make improvements, even starting as recently as this week. So we know that they haven't forgotten about the problems. They're doing apparently what they possibly can. And so the reports like this just kind of keep your mind on the future, I suppose.
Well, right, and we also like people to evaluate all public policies against this. So the example, your previous segment was about the data centers. Well, mm-hmm. City of Hammond just, you know, gave up, you know, several tens or of millions of dollars in taxes to get a data center that's going to bring most data centers bring about 30 jobs. And so the fact that Hammond is, without being, you know, particularly critical of that decision, think about, you know, would the community have, they just passed a referendum on schools in Hammond, so the workers there, the taxpayers obviously care about the performance of schools, which are below average. Would they have had, would gathering some taxes from that data center been a better option? Can you really afford to spend, $2 million per job if that's all the the number of jobs that are going to be created at that data center over the next 30 years. Mm-hmm. And so those sorts of really tough decisions that play into what we prioritize in terms of economic development have to be on the table. And this report is designed to make communities ask the tough questions. So, you know, we can be excited about new jobs and new technology, but do we really have the labor force that's going to create a new Google Research and Development Center in Hammond? Do we have a community that's going to attract people to move here to take those sorts of jobs? And if the answer is no, then giving incentives to bring those jobs here is likely a waste of time.
The Community Asset Inventory and Rankings Report, the latest one, is out this week. It's come out from the Center for Business and Economic Research at Ball State University. And Professor Michael Hicks, the Executive Director of the CBER, with us to talk about it. Professor Hicks, thanks very much. And I hope we can get more data, and we'll have a chance to talk with you again soon.
Oh, thank you. It was a delight being with you.
Thank you. This is Regionally Speaking. 5 years ago, a team of greening experts worked with the city of Gary and the residents in the Etna neighborhood in the city's very first big repurposing project. Vacant to Vibrant project manager Sandra Albro just put out a book on her experiences in the Steel City, and she was on Regionally Speaking to talk about them.
I'm based in Cleveland, Ohio, and this is a problem that we're facing here in Cleveland. We also worked in Buffalo. So a lot of post-industrial cities throughout the Great Lakes region have these problems with vacant lots, and we're trying to figure out what to do with them. So the Etna neighborhood of Gary was interesting because of the vacant land that they had. We received a grant from the Great Lakes Protection Fund to look at different greening strategies that could be useful for small vacant lots that are embedded among houses and residents, specifically because we were seeing other types of vacant land, like large industrial parcels being looked at, but we weren't seeing these smaller vacant lots being examined, and in some ways those can be harder to use.
I know a lot of cases you hear about the term greenfields, and that's, of course, what an EPA likes to use as a term for ones sites that have a particular amount of contamination to deal with, too, as well as being vacant. So we're not talking necessarily about contaminated sites, but we're talking about sites that have been vacant and then sore use of the resources that are out there. How did you get involved with this project with the city of Gary? Did you find out it from them? Did you consult with them before things really got started in the Etna neighborhood?
I did. We were hosting a series of regional discussions in around 2009, 2010, amongst professionals from different Great Lakes cities to talk about vacant lots and this overlap between community and environmental concerns that different cities were facing, and specifically how vacant lots could be repurposed in ways that helped address those needs. So the city of Gary was very active in those early discussions, and it quickly became apparent that not only was the city of Gary, you know, they had the demonstrated need, but they also had the capacity and interest to try vacant land strategies that hadn't been fully worked out yet. So they were a great partner from the start.
When you get a project like this started, even if you're at the very beginning of the process, you obviously have to consult with people at City Hall. Who did you end up talking to at first as you got things started? And then, of course, then you have to actually go into the neighborhood, wherever you're working, in this case in the Etna neighborhood, and talk with the residents. Tell us about what cooperation you needed to get from Gary City Hall first and then from the neighbors themselves.
We've been working mostly with Brenda Scott-Henry, who is in the Department of Green Urbanism and the Gary Stormwater District. Mm-hmm. And Brenda has been a wonderful partner for years and was involved in these early discussions amongst the region. Also, someone who had previously worked in the Department of Green Urbanism, Lauren Riga, was a participant in these discussions. So that was our in at the City of Gary. They were looking at issues of stormwater management to prevent combined sewer overflow, and they also had all of these vacant parcels, and this aligned well with needs that we had identified both in Cleveland and Buffalo. Then once we got to the city of Gary, we relied on a lot. The Department of Green Urbanism has some good roots in the Etna neighborhood, and so we worked with the department, we worked with local churches, and then we also talked a lot directly with residents. We went door to door, we held community meetings, we went to other community meetings that they were already holding, and through just a variety of methods to capture, you know, different residents and a variety of feedback, we went through a multi-month planning process with residents, hearing their concerns and their desires for their neighborhood, and then working with designers to try to translate those needs and concerns into plans for these little parcels that could help address those needs and concerns.
I know that the Environmental Resilience Institute, which is based at IU Bloomington, has worked extensively with the city of Gary and with you all, I'm sure, on this. And there are pictures that they happen to have on their Environmental Resilience Institute website that show some of the projects. I guess there are, what, three in particular, the vacant to vibrant sites that were set up in the Aetna neighborhood. What did you all take a look at first when you went into a particular neighborhood after talking with the residents, getting the input from them in that process, to take a look and see what's there and what you all and the people that have come in to do the work can actually do?
As soon as we identified Aetna as a focus in Gary, we looked at all of the vacant parcels in Aetna. And we, you know, just looked at the different characteristics of those parcels. You know, did they have houses on them? Had they been demolished? What kinds of soils were there? How many people lived around them? And what types of indicators were on the parcels that might tell us about, you know, what residents wanted from them? So, for example, a simple footpath that residents have worn down through a vacant lot could indicate that they would like a formalized path or a trail to help them get from point A to point B. And so the three parcels that we looked at and we ended up focusing on in Aetna, one of them is on a prominent corner right as you come into the neighborhood. Aetna neighborhood actually predates Gary, and so there's a lot of neighborhood pride around the name of the neighborhood and just announcing to residents or to visitors that they've arrived in Aetna. Mm-hmm. So for this prominent corner lot, we ended up coming up with a design that just was a sign of announcing the name of the neighborhood and a series of rain gardens to capture stormwater runoff and help alleviate that stormwater or the combined sewer overflow.
In some of these sites that you all took a look at and you decided to choose to use in the project, were there any houses abandoned or otherwise that were on the sites that you had to take care of first?
Yeah, because of our close relationship with the city of Gary, we were able to do something special in Gary that we couldn't do in Cleveland and Buffalo, and that was to work with the city prior to demolition. So two of the parcels that we worked on had houses. One of the houses had been vacant for 15 to 20 years, long enough that people in the community didn't remember who used to live there. And then another house had been burned out and was there for about 5 or 6 years. City was able to get federal funding to help demolish those houses, but we started working with them before the houses even came down. One of the cool things about that process is that behind one of the burnt-out house, there was a really nice cinder block decorative wall and a little walled garden in the backyard. We were able to preserve that wall because we worked with the city prior to demolition, and we turned that into a walled garden that makes a nice picnic space or a good community gathering.
That's Sandra Albro, who was the project manager at the time of Vacant to Vibrant when it was in existence in the Aetna neighborhood. Nationwide, e-cigarette use rose at alarming 78% among high school students last year. The FDA has warned manufacturers to stop marketing to kids by using fruity flavors and colorful packaging. But that hasn't stopped the surge, even in rural areas where access to stores is limited. Lita Noon tells us about a school in Newton County.
North Newton Junior Senior High lies in the northwest corner of Indiana, in a county home to more dairy cows than people. But students have no problem getting e-cigarettes in all shapes and sizes. Some look like pens, others like computer thumb drives.
Probably most people my age, if you're not a smoker or none of that, it could be sitting right in front of you and you wouldn't even know what it was.
That's teacher Bob Gonzi, who took an informal poll of PE students. Junior high kids estimate 65% of their classmates are using vape devices, and high school students think their numbers are even higher. Assistant Principal Jerry Taylor dumps a bag full of confiscated materials onto a desk. There are vape pens, a bottle of marshmallow-flavored e-liquid, an electronic charger, and the highly popular Juul brand devices.
There's been 34 vaping episodes, and we put kids out 3 days.
Taylor explains that without a specific vape policy, they're following the 3-day suspensions of the smoking policy. Because e-cigarettes are so easy to hide, they're very disruptive in classrooms. Health teacher Josh Stringfellow says students blow smoke rings while the teacher is turned away.
They'll film it on Snapchat, send it around the school because, hey, I got away with it in so-and-so's class. I did this trick in this teacher's classroom. And now it's they're one-upping each other. And that's why they're being caught more easily, is because they're being so blatant about it.
A senior from nearby Lowell High School, Kate Holdeman, says vaping became the hot thing after winter break last year.
It's pretty crazy. It's definitely an epidemic. I mean, for a long time, you like couldn't walk into a restroom without like vapor just being in your face, because everybody at some point did it.
Holdeman says he doesn't use e-cigarettes, but his friends do. And his mom, Stacy Stewart, says that's worrisome.
My smart kid over here started hanging out with some not smart kids who did stuff like that. And I mean, it was in his car a lot. And we had a blow up about it. I mean, it's better now, but it's just scary because there's so many health things that kids just don't realize.
And those health consequences are real. Newton County Public Health Nurse Kim Durham says the problem, nicotine.
What we're really still looking at, once again, are people having a nicotine addiction. This is the kind of stuff that leads to heart disease later, that leads to cardiovascular problems, that can lead to pulmonary problems. There's all kinds of different things that can go into play here.
She spoke to 6th and 8th graders at school health fairs.
I was actually mostly surprised because we asked them where they started doing it, and a lot of them said, well, my parents do it. And some of them had, that's kind of how they ended up getting introduced to it, was mom and dad.
Durham says there's a misconception e-cigarettes are safe because some people use them to stop smoking. But she says nicotine levels can be much higher in e-cigarettes. North Newton administrators want to curb the use of e-cigarettes next year. Taylor says they're considering having the local police get involved.
Start ticketing these kids if it's $150 or whatever. And maybe that would curtail them buying these vapes and bringing them into school.
Gonzi agrees that that will make a difference.
You know, we find out here, hold the parents responsible. Hold the parents responsible. You get in their pocketbook a little bit, they'll curb behaviors, especially for their children.
For next fall, Gonzi and Taylor are working toward a school e-cigarette policy. They also want to develop information for the curriculum and for parents. Meanwhile, they'll get some help from the FDA. New ads about the dangers of e-cigarettes are scheduled to hit the airwaves this summer. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Lee Dinoon.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Tomorrow we have, among other things, revisiting some of our conversations with members of Northwest Indiana's legislative delegation, and we hope you'll join us.